This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome to another Motorsport Magazine podcast on yet another fantastic day in London. Every time we do a podcast, we seem to have this absolutely fantastic weather. The doors open overlooking the River Thames. Wonderful. We have one of our own with us today. And she's also building up a reputation as a broadcaster on the BBC as well, so that's all good. But we're looking forward to talking to Lee McKenzie today, yes, who's our regular contributor to our website after each Grand Prix. So she's on her way from Bahrain to Barcelona via Chelsea Wharf in London. Welcome, Lee.
Thank you very much for having me back. It's always a pleasure.
Good. It is for us too. Let's dive straight in to what is one of the big topics of the moment, and that is the rivalry between Lewis and Nico. Who's winding who up and why, and what's going on? I mean, Nico looks like a beaten man, yes, no?
Yeah, it's interesting. I would hope there would be a little bit more rivalry than there actually has been this year. We could always rely on Nico on the Saturdays, and that just hasn't been the case at all this year. You know, he got a trophy. The only trophy, sadly, for him last year was the pole winner's trophy. And Lewis has beaten him hands down every Saturday and Sunday. But I thought his comments after the Chinese Grand Prix were just a little bit odd. You'd have to imagine that he absolutely believed what he said about Lewis trying to back him up into Sebastian. Yeah. But when he hadn't lost that second position to Sebastian, there was no hard evidence for journalists or the general public to see. Maybe they have data which suggests otherwise, but I just thought it was a really odd thing to come out with at that time, and I don't think it did him any favours. He sounded as if he was just clutching at straws by that point. But even in Australia, he came out with on Saturday after qualifying that Lewis had qualified like a world champion, which at the time I thought, well, maybe he's trying to fire himself up, and then if he can beat this fabulous world champion, then that, you know, psychologically is he even stronger. But I don't quite understand. He's overthinking everything, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that struck me in China was, and Lewis is perfectly entitled as race leader to drive at whatever speed he likes, and if the bloke behind catches him and passes him, that's his end lookout. I mean, Nico wasn't able to do that, and kept going on about not being able to get close enough and blah, blah, blah. Max Verstappen didn't have any problem passing people, did he?
That's true.
Have you seen a change in Lewis at all in the last few months? He seems just so assured at the moment, full of that confidence you'd get from winning so many races.
Yeah, he's coming across as someone who, whether you see him on a celebrity chat show programme or in an interview in the paddock, he has got so much confidence. Now, whether he is just using this momentum to be even more dominating and incredible, or whether Nico's resolve has gone, I'm not quite sure. But Nico fought back in Bahrain. Nico was much stronger in Bahrain. So whether he needed to stoke up a little fire in China to sort of stoke up a fire within himself again, I don't know. But it's quite a detrimental way of working. It's something that we sometimes saw from Mark Webber, actually, when he was in the heat of a battle against Sebastian Vettel. Sometimes Mark needed to cause a little bit of mischief to get himself back on track. And I'm not quite sure if it's that sort of same way of thinking.
Okay. Well, time will tell, won't it? We're only, what, four races in, are we?
Four races in.
But he looks in trouble to me, because, I mean, he's got to beat him at some point the next couple of races if he's going to stand any chance of actually doing what he did last year and taking the fight to him. It's just looking like, it doesn't look like he's got it in him at the moment.
But he's got to beat him. He's also got to beat Sebastian Vettel at the moment. Because I thought it was really odd after the Bahrain qualifying when Nico said that he didn't see what I said about, and Sebastian, it's not just Lewis in front of you, it's Sebastian as well. And he said, yeah, I didn't see that coming. Well, why did he not see that coming? I just thought that was honest, naive, I'm not quite sure, but it was a really odd thing to say.
He's amazingly honest, isn't he?
Oh, yeah, he's absolutely, he's really? Far too honest.
Yeah, too honest, absolutely.
Yeah, actually, he looks like a man with something else on his mind to me. He looks very slightly distracted by something. I don't know what
he
is.
He is about to become a father in August, maybe.
But Lewis is on fire, isn't he? He's
on a different level.
Yeah.
I wonder if the sports personality win has had an influence on him at all, because he's that recognition of the public, the acceptance of the public. He never really had that fully before, and maybe he has now. I don't know if that's a factor.
Maybe it's something to do with the Nicole situation, the Scherzinger situation. Maybe because that's all kind of out the way.
Yeah. I just think if you bring a dog onto a red carpet, you're going to win an award. I know, do you know what, actually, at that night, because I was hosting the red carpet, the pre-one-hour show, and afterwards, Rory McIlroy's family said, next year, we're going to turn up with a pack of hounds. I was like, he was like so absolutely sure that it was Roscoe that had won Sports Personality of the Year and not Lewis. So, but I was in Monza on Friday, and Roscoe was there toddling around as well, which was lovely. So, yeah, that's the perfect relationship, I think, Lewis and his dog.
Oh, for those of you who are not familiar with the BBC Sports Personality of the Year, Mr. Hamilton took his dog Roscoe to the ceremony. Good, okay. Surprises this year, Ferrari, obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, what have they done over the winter? Do you know exactly? I mean, there are stories that they did a lot of this work in England. They got some of the carbon fibre done in England, some of the engine management, rather than in Italy as previously.
Well, I think they gave up on that car pretty early last season as well, and then were able just to purely concentrate on this year. I think James Allison's been just fantastic, and although he says that there's not much on the car this year that's actually his own work, I think he's being incredibly humble. And when I was coming back from Monza on Friday, he was coming back on the same Milan flight as well, and I think there's just a huge amount of respect for him within that team. And even at the end of last year, that just seemed an absolute disarray, and then new team bosses coming in, to the point that Sebastian, I can't imagine, was sure who on earth he'd signed for or who with. And all of a sudden, for them to, you know, they were there or thereabouts in pre-season testing, but quite often are. And then you get to Australia, and it's a grande casino, as they would say. And they were fantastic, and they've been consistent throughout. I think, as a team, the amount of work that they've done over the winter, but sort of the second half of last year and over the winter, has been incredible to turn that round.
I mean, they had a lot to find.
Yeah,
I mean,
they did.
So, I mean, to come from where they were to here is I think it's a testament to Alison, really. You know, Mark Hughes has written a piece for our next issue, out this week, of course. And he talks about the Ross Brawn influence, that Alison worked with Ross Brawn for a long time. And for me, he's that kind of character who galvanises a team and gets them working in the right direction, helps each department focus and sees the bigger picture as well. And I think, you know, he's not physically doing every job in the factory. It doesn't. That's what he's not there for. But he's there organising things and getting things working in the right way. And this is the result, I think.
And the other thing, of course, is that they knew what was wrong, or they knew several of the things that were wrong with last year's car, but of course the regulations didn't allow them to remedy them. So, you know, once they got round to developing the 2015 engine, they were, you know, they knew where to go straight away, and the evidence has been manifest.
And I guess from our perspective of hoping for good races this year, we're relying on Ferrari quite a bit now, by the looks of it.
Yeah, we do.
I mean, from race to race, we're not going to know what we've got until we get there, really, in terms of how the tyres are performing and the characteristics of that Ferrari, which at least gives us something to cling on to. Otherwise, it'd be a Mercedes walkover.
I think it's just great to see them back at the front, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a bit of a Ferrari fan, actually. I like the whole Italian thing, and they make nice cars, and, you know, it's great to... I think it's good for motor racing, don't you?
But I think also we shouldn't underestimate the effect that Sebastian has had within the team as well. And publicly and privately, the team are saying how nice it is to have someone with that really positive attitude to be in there and galvanising people and spurring them on, as opposed to sort of making mischief in the background, which might have been happening when Fernando was there. You know, I'm not doubting that he wanted to win with that team at all. You know, that's what he's there for. But Sebastian has a very different approach, yeah. And it's worked very well for him because it's making him seem a better racer, answering any critics that he may have had as well.
Yeah, I'm pleased to see that, because I think Seb's had a very hard time, unjustly, over the years. People haven't given him the credit that he was due, yeah. And I'm pleased to see that in this situation people are actually. I mean, why people forget how good he was in the Toro Rosso,
yeah.
At the end of 2008, and even, you know, flashes in the end of 2007 as well. I think, you know, it's nice to see that the wider public are actually giving him some credit at last.
What was he like to deal with last year, given the hard time he was having?
Well, he wasn't. I have a good relationship with Sebastian, and he's fun. He's mischievous. He's flirtatious in interviews, which gets everyone into trouble. But he's clever. He knows exactly what he's doing. And last year we didn't see that at all. I did a nice sit-down piece with him at Silverstone, and he was just, I don't know, tired is the way I would describe it. And then I spoke to him for quite a while in Malaysia, and he just said that he was really happy last year. You know, more often than not, because he wasn't understanding probably why Daniel was beating him, why he couldn't suddenly get the best out of the car. So he doubted himself. There's a story that between Bahrain and Barcelona, he got in a, well, glorified transit van and went off and went to Kerpen and went karting, mm-hmm. and just needed to sort of go karting and find himself and try and enjoy motor racing. And yeah. When I interviewed him in Silverstone last year, I found a quote, because I was doing Wimbledon as well, and I found a Roger Federer quote which went along the lines of, you know, sometimes the media and people at home need to realise that this is a dream. Why you started as a child, you just actually want to go out and enjoy it. And even the bad times, they're not bad, are they? And I printed this quote out and I gave it to him, and he was really touched. He was, you thought of me when you read this? And Roger Federer said this. I was like, yeah, don't take this the wrong way. It's just a piece of A4 with some words on it. And but that's exactly what it was. And yeah. But you need to have, and when I interviewed Lewis and Sebastian together, you need to have, as far as Lewis was saying, that sort of difficult time to really appreciate it when it comes good again. And Sebastian had 4 fantastic years. Well, Lewis had gone from 2008 to 2014 before he won a championship again. And he said he just appreciated it so much better. So maybe that's why Sebastian's better this year as well, because he hadn't had a really tough time before in Formula One.
No, he hadn't.
That was a wonderful interview you did with Vettel and Hamilton for the BBC. May I say so?
Thank you very much.
It was great.
We were both in very good form.
Great TV, and we should have much more of that. So it's not a compliment, it's a challenge.
Okay, right. Well, let me see who I can get.
Okay, Max Verstappen.
Yes.
Now, not really under the category of surprise, but even so, quite an eye-opener, isn't he?
It is, but I think a lot of people carry big reputations and then they come in and they might not have the tools to deliver or they might get, you know, unstuck in situations. And even when he doesn't finish a race, it doesn't seem to matter, because from the very first moment, he will prove himself. And I think he's just such a lovely person to deal with. He always has Jos in the background as well over his shoulder. But when I spoke to him after Malaysia, when we'd had that big delay because of the rains, and then I think he went and qualified 6th, was it?
Yeah.
And I asked him, you know, sort of, how do you prepare for this? And he said, well, I watched loads of old videos of racing in the rain in Malaysia. And you think, God, you're young enough to be at school and you're treating Formula One like it's a school project. You know, he's studying things, and he's that's what he does. He comes to the races, he does the work at the races, he flies straight back home, and then he absolutely prepares. There's no distractions. He's not in that sort of category where he's going off and doing modelling shoots or chat shows or anything quite at this moment. So he can, treat it as a project. Yeah. And he's doing that. He's really doing the hard work. But he's just lovely to deal with, and he's incredible, isn't he?
He's so young.
But I'm delighted for him, and also for Carlos Sainz Jr., who I think's been doing a really good job on a Saturday. well, and Sundays, they've both been let down by the Toro Rosso, but the fact that they've got a car that's able to let them show what they can do, okay, you know, it's been difficult with reliability on a Sunday, but there's enough glimpses of progress and hope that they can show something special.
I think Sainz, I mean, I think it's been very impressive, because who would really want to be Carlos Sainz this year, coming into that team with with Max Verstappen, the reputation he's got and all the rest of it. He's done really well, actually, to deal with it.
But in some ways, he's got nothing to lose, because if he out-qualifies or beats Max, then surely his star is shining brighter. I think there was that time where we thought that Daniel Ricciardo and Jean-Éric Vergne, that was a big inter-team battle to get to Red Bull, and they were sort of slogging it out to show how good they were. But what I hope doesn't happen is if, you know, say Max gets a Red Bull seat or something, you don't want Carlos Sainz to go off into the depths of sort of nothingness or become a third driver for someone, because I think that's where Red Bull have been great at bringing young talent through, but the ones that maybe aren't quite good enough to get to Red Bull, they're just discarded.
Yeah, yeah.
And I do think that's a shame, because I don't think a Vergne is necessarily a bad driver, and I hope whoever, you know, loses out in that inter-team battle doesn't just go off and go into sort of be a third driver.
I know what you mean about the Red Bull scheme being fairly brutal if you're not quite good enough, but they do. I mean, with the case like, say, Buemi and Alguersuari, I mean, between them, they had done 100 Grand Prix between them by the time they were a collective age of 44. So they'd been given a fantastic opportunity.
They had
to that. But I mean, you are right. They are only accepting, you know, the creme de la creme.
But I think Alguersuari and Buemi were maybe different in that neither of them, alongside each other, were sparkling too much, whereas Vergne and Ricciardo, I think Vergne actually finished that championship season off with just marginally less points than Ricciardo. So, yeah, you know, I mean, that's quite tough. But in this instance, all I mean is I think that they're both, we're always talking about Max Verstappen, and quite rightly so. But I don't think Carlos is doing a bad job at all either. And I think he should be given almost the same amount of respect, because if Max wasn't there, we'd be, you know, sort of hailing him as the next great thing.
No, I mean, I agree. And I think it's also quite interesting because, you know, his track record the last couple of three seasons, apart from winning Renault 3-5 last year, has been a bit patchy. Mm. But Red Bull have always maintained that whenever he's been in the F1 car, he's looked really good.
Yeah.
And it was only a sort of freak set of circumstances kicked off by Sebastian, which led to, you know, there being a seat available when the music stopped. And
I think,
you know, all things considered, he's done very, very well.
Yeah.
Let's not forget his dad was a bit special.
Yes, exactly.
I'm old enough to have watched his dad in Formula Ford.
Absolutely.
Before he got anywhere near a rally car.
Okay. Mana Marussia. What are they doing there?
You've gone all Bernie on us. What are they
doing there? No, it's not that I don't like the guys or I don't have a good view of the team. I really mean the question. I mean,
I don't know how you attract sponsors. I think it's a very, very difficult end of the grid.
Sure.
Anyway, you can see that when you look at McLaren.
Sure.
Drivers walking around in white overalls with no branding on it, like they're sort of wannabe Stigs. You know, it's bizarre. Yeah. So then you get Sauber, who have finally got some sponsors, and you have Mana Marussia with no sponsors.
Yeah.
And I honestly don't know. Do they just plow on with that car and, you know, get to end of year and start trying to look at a car for next season? I mean, it's a long old year to do that.
Yep.
They're also not working out of the base that they had as Marussia. So I think they've got an incredibly tough job. I hope for their sake that they succeed. And when I say succeed, I mean see out to the end of the season.
Sure,
you just have to... You just have to hope that there's a bigger picture somewhere.
And that maybe they might score a few points, which makes the crucial difference.
Yeah, sadly, I wonder if those opportunities have gone.
Yeah, I think.
Because when every time everyone gets to Barcelona, they should be slightly more together, shouldn't they, really? Even the backmarkers should be slightly more together. Those points of the opportunistic points, you know, surely that was in Australia when only 15 cars started and they didn't start.
So
that's unlikely to happen again now, as you say.
Exactly.
So,
I mean, there's an outside chance in Monaco if you get a sufficient first lap chaos in the middle of the field or something, but otherwise.
But don't forget when that happened last year, I think they had, with all due respect, I don't think Will Stevens has done a bad job. Roberto Meri is off the pace, but he's very inexperienced. But you had Jules last year, who was, you know, seen as a real talent. Mm. And he was, and he put himself in positions in that car to capitalise on those points, which I'm not quite sure if the drivers they have now would be.
They haven't got the experience.
Not yet.
No.
I mean, the from the BBC's perspective, Will Stevens' stories must be a tricky one. British driver in Formula One, after all. But what can you do with him? It's very difficult. It's
difficult even on our. I mean, I'll interview him every Saturday and Sunday, which I try and interview all the drivers, but sometimes that just doesn't happen, and. It is a difficult one. I used to do the same with Max anyway. You know, you never know what they've got to say. But it is a difficult one. It's difficult to build up a story around a team which is, you know, just almost attending. And I say that, it's difficult because the guys running it are very nice, very committed, you know, working every hour that God gives. But you're right, for what? I don't know.
Tricky. You've referred to Fernando Alonso. You didn't name him, but we were talking about last year. And we've referred to McLaren this year. For me, this is actually a really big story in many respects. I mean, no sponsors, a lot of support from Honda, and you'd kind of think they're going to get there, wouldn't you? I mean, why wouldn't they? Jensen's come back, you know, he got the drive. How do you think Jens is feeling about
it? It's not what he'd hoped for, is it, really? No. I mean, I think that promise of McLaren and Honda together again was fantastic. And they didn't just announce it, you know, on the last day in Abu Dhabi. They've had, months, a couple of years to think about this. Yeah. And you sort of saw it not working out in pre-season testing, and then you have to hope that the second test they'll be there, the third test. But it makes no sense, really. You know, I think when I went to the third test in Barcelona, the car did 33 laps. Jensen one day got it and did 101 laps, and it still stopped at the end. You know, it still didn't stop when they wanted it to stop. It's just really bizarre. And then not to be able to start that race in Bahrain is... It's kind of unforgivable, really, as well. Yeah, it is. It's not the right environment for McLaren to not be starting a Grand Prix, which effectively is seen as one of their home Grand Prix. Yeah. But, you know, they've just had problem after problem, whether it be Fernando Alonso's crash to, the last time out. Fernando's adamant that by the time we get to Barcelona, he will be in a point-scoring position. Now, you would have to say that, albeit slowly, progress has been made. Yeah. He finished 11th in Bahrain. But, you know, you've got two former world champions fighting over possibly one point. I mean, I think Fernando seems to get himself into the wrong place at the wrong time, time and time again. I think, what's the stat? He's 6 points off or 8 points off being a 5-time world champion. I don't know how he can go to sleep and relax at night. He obviously just has to accept that. But that is heartbreaking in so many ways.
It's mind-blowing, yes.
He has got a couple, though. I mean,
he's got a couple.
It can't be that difficult to sleep at night.
I never feel sorry for a Formula One driver, but I do think, I do think that he has got so much sort of unfulfilled potential.
I concur. I mean, when he did his back-to-back, well, even before he won his back-to-back titles with Renault, you foresaw, a stack of world championships was just going to accumulate, and as we know, it hasn't happened.
I mean, we know he's good at his card tricks, and he's had years and years of practicing that poker face. Do you see any chink of frustration in him? Because he seems to have the facade really.
I'd like to say yes, but worryingly, there's not been anything, and neither from Jensen either. You don't want to see people accepting it's okay to not start a Grand Prix. And when I was doing media training with a lot of young drivers, I always used to say to them, don't look happy when you don't finish a race, or don't look delighted to be second unless you know that you've given absolutely everything and you are happy to be second. But Fernando and Jensen, I think maybe it's maturity and having won a lot of Grand Prix and things in the past, but they are accepting of a situation. So you have to presume that they are doing absolutely everything within that team to improve, but to not be able to start the car, I think, until a couple of hours before the Bahrain Grand Prix, a car which didn't start on the Sunday or the Saturday, or barely got going on the Saturday, that's not right.
But maybe they know a lot of things that we don't. Well, yeah, yes. Well, obviously they do know a lot of things that we don't. But and Ron Dennis has said that they will win a Grand Prix this year. Now,
yes. My dad once said that about McLaren. He ended up running around Silverstone naked. So that no one make a bet, for heaven's sake.
I wouldn't want to see Ron do that. I didn't really want to see your dad do that
no.
either, but
oh,
I definitely wouldn't want to see Ron do that.
weren't you wearing a T-shirt saying, apologies, Silver? You had some
really
sort of apology on your T-shirt.
Yeah, because I felt like the daughter and absolutely fabulous. It's just really embarrassed by the parents. So I got a T-shirt made up that said, the Oh My Godfather, and then the charity on the back to also make clear that he's not just a random weirdo running around naked, that actually there was a charitable donation involved. But that was quite a funny story because he had tried to, what he said on radio was, just for anyone listening that just thinks that I come from a family of streakers, he'd said on radio with Mark Webber, if McLaren win a race this year, he would do anything. And Mark Webber said to him, well, what would you do? This was on Radio 5. He said, well, I don't know, I'd run around Silverstone naked. And then Spa, I think, did Kimi win in Spa that year? I can't remember what it was.
Yeah,
I think it was.
Did, yeah.
And it was just horrendous. So he was going to hire Silverstone and do it on Boxing Day or Christmas Day. My Christmas Day as a kid was going to be having to watch this, and I was thinking, that's not on. And then he was going to buy a dog, call it Silverstone, call it Naked, and run around Silverstone with Naked. And this went on and on. But he knew he was absolutely done for when Max Mosley and the FIA donated to the charity. He said that was it. They knew that there was going to be no going back. And DC was meant to stop the drivers' parade because it happened on the Sunday of the British Grand Prix. And Bernie, for the first time ever, set the drivers' parade off early, 15 minutes early.
Never let it be said he doesn't have a sense of humour.
No. A poor woman had to body paint him. That's the woman I feel sorry for.
Good stories. I like it. I like it. I like it a lot. Okay. But maybe we'll all be eating our words when they win the World Championship in 2016 and Alonso picks up another world title. I mean, hey, you know, if Honda can't get it right, who the hell can?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that Fernando has been out to... Well, I think Fernando and Jensen have been out to Japan to see Honda, and Honda haven't been shying away from the problem. They're present and putting themselves up for interviews and things. And you know, Japanese companies, this is the most embarrassing thing for a Japanese company. Not even to be not able to qualify, but to not start a Grand Prix is just, you know, it's not acceptable at all. So they will be doing absolutely everything to try and rectify that.
But they have got one hand tied behind the back because they've only got two cars. Well, last year, every other engine manufacturer had at least four cars.
Absolutely.
So it's in every way, it's a, you know, it's a huge uphill struggle.
Yeah. I think in terms of the people I'd least like to be in Formula One this year, in Australia, Manisha Kaltenborn.
Oh, yeah.
Don't want to be here. That was horrendous. But over a course of a season, Eric Boullier being in that position there with Ron Dennis on his shoulder, that's got to be difficult, isn't it? I mean, with the way things are going.
Well, I think that started in by the third test in Barcelona when McLaren, who are the most professional of teams and everything is done, you know, with no expense spared, a piece of A4 was stuck to the motorhome saying Ron Dennis and Eric Boullier press conference regarding Fernando Alonso at 12 o'clock. And it wasn't until afterwards, and it wasn't a successful press conference, to put it mildly. And then we realised that Eric Boullier hadn't been there. And we were like, do you think Ron's locked him in the office or something? Because Ron wanted to commandeer the whole thing himself. So there was no sign of Eric, which Eric probably didn't mind by the end of that at all. He was probably delighted not to have been involved in that. But even by that point, you know, it was meant to be the two of them. And Ron had said, no, actually, I'm going to take this one on myself.
Yeah.
I think the one positive thing this year from McLaren is that Jensen's radio comments have been comedy gold. I mean, he could get his own Radio 4 series on a Monday evening at 6:30. I mean, with Kimi as a guest. I mean, that has been what I mean. I've just about his attitude during races. Oh, I'm catching another car. That kind of thing. It's just been great. It is lovely. Yeah.
It's how a kid would think, isn't it? It's a sort of observations of a child. Yeah. Oh my goodness, there's another car.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the BBC. For obvious reasons, Lee McKenzie.
I've never had a fracas, that what you're going to ask? There's still time.
Not yet.
Not yet. Where's my steak?
You must have punched Eddie Jordan at some point, sure.
Yeah, actually, that's true. Yeah.
But what are the odds on you for the job then? That's the question.
But I did see a list and I was in it and I was very excited. I thought, this is great, I'm going to screen grab this. And then I saw that Nigel Farage had a better chance. And I thought, oh no, that's actually quite humiliating. So yeah, so probably not as good as I'd hope.
Okay, well, Top Gear fans, what do you think? Lee McKenzie for the job? I'd like her to stay on Formula One, actually. But anyway, there we go. Within the BBC, what's the talk about what needs to be done to Formula One? Because obviously, it's very, you know, it's important to a broadcaster. They don't want plummeting viewing figures. And anyway, how much, we wonder, does the audience actually care about all the technology and about, you know, do we go to Monza, don't we go to Monza, is there a German Grand Prix? Well, let's start with the viewing figures.
Well, our viewing figures are unusual globally in that they're going up. Race on race, we're still getting more than we got last year, which is fantastic. And even for our highlights races, you know, we get really good viewing figures, which in some ways you don't want, because you want the viewing figures to always be high for the live races. But then I think the more races you have in a season, the less time fans have to devote to, you know, a free practice, 1, 2, 3, a qualifying. I mean, you've got to have a pretty understanding partner to suddenly hand over, like, you know, 15 hours on a weekend,
and quite a
20
bit of,
times a year or something like that.
And quite a bit of free time.
Our viewing figures are really strong, which is great, you know, but it's not like that around the world. And it doesn't seem, it's, you know, we talk about the Lewis factor and things. It doesn't seem to really matter. They were strong when Sebastian was winning races. Yeah. But the fact that they have gone up this year, you would think that, you know, Lewis is a slight, gives people a slight interest. But then no one wants to see someone dominating a championship. So what happens by the time you get to long summer days and, you know, do people want to sit down and watch the Hungarian Grand Prix to watch Lewis win again? Maybe not. So much of it depends on other sporting occasions, sunny days, and that's what stage you're at in the championship.
I was just going to say, you know, obviously our audience is slightly smaller, but obviously with motorsport, it's a specialist audience who, you know, they're diehard enthusiasts. And there's a level of disenchantment that we've expressed to us on our website and in letters to the magazine. Are you getting any sort of feedback from the fans?
You tend to get that mostly on social media, really. I mean, I do think that Australia was dire. I don't know if there was any redeeming factor over that weekend, apart from the fact that everyone got back home safely. It was dire from the Thursday, with the whole Sauber situation. Just, you know, you don't want to start off a season in that way, talking about negatives, and then 15 cars starting the Grand Prix was just embarrassing. And the reaction after that, I was quite shocked. You know, you go on thinking, okay, let's just have a look. And even after I'd written my column, people were saying, you know, how can you... I hadn't said it was a good weekend by any stretch of the imagination, but I think it's also very difficult. You don't want to protect the sport in which you work, but you certainly don't want to bring it down and say, you know, I've never seen such a terrible... You know. It's difficult. I think year on year, people seem to think that they're watching a bad sport. I remember, I think, was it a few years ago, we had 7 winners of the first 7 Grand Prix.
Yeah, 2012, yeah.
And people were still moaning that it was boring.
I, after the Spanish Grand Prix, I walked back to my hotel and there was a punter in there who accosted me. It's in my media pass. And he said, that's all false.
Yeah.
And I said, what's false? He said, well, you shouldn't have 7 different winners in 7 races. It's not possible. You know, Michael Schumacher should win them all, or what, you know. And he just thought, well, hang on a second. we're going to the races not knowing what's happening. It was because of the jelly Pirelli tyres we had at the time,
which was
putting certain cars into certain windows at certain times, and it was all very varied.
But they were doing what they were asked to do in fairness
Absolutely. But as you say, you'd think, well, hang on a second, you've come to Spain to watch the race. You think maybe a Ferrari or a Red Bull's going to win it, and Pastor Maldonado, who normally crashes at every opportunity, has resisted fantastic pressure from Fernando Alonso and has conjured a wonderful victory. And then you've got the Williams Pitfire afterwards and all sorts of other dramas. And he was unhappy about it, thought the whole thing was false. And then started moaning about a problem with the Porsche Super Cup race being cancelled because of wheel rims. What was all that about?
It
was just most bizarre.
I do find it interesting when people always say that, you know, F1 at this time is dull. And I do have a certain amount of sympathy for that. You know, when you have races like Australia, not good. China wasn't a classic by any stretch of the imagination. I quite like to find out what days people are looking back to, because I think a lot of that is actually age relevant. You know, if you're thinking back to the 60s, if you're old enough to remember that, if you're thinking back to, you know, I was with Sterling Moss on Friday, his stories of 1955 are some of the best you've ever heard, but most people can't remember back to those days. Yeah. So I think a lot of it is dependent on which era you come from and what you like. I'm not defending it necessarily this year. I think we've had a couple of really poor races, but it's that same thing. Do you... You know, we had to thank Mercedes last year for letting Nico and Lewis race. Otherwise, that would have been a desperately boring season. As it happened, it was a pretty exciting season. Mm. But if they had...
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Justifiably said, you know what, let's have a number one driver. That could have been one of the most boring seasons we've ever had.
Yeah. It comes and goes, doesn't it?
I mean,
come on, if you look back over the... I mean, I love it all, actually. Mm. You know, you get the odd boring race.
Yeah, okay, absolutely. But I do think when you mention losing... Monza or certainly Germany, that does leave a really bad taste in my mouth, because these are the circuits that that attract proper great racing. You don't have runoff that you can go for 25 kilometres towards Shanghai before you actually touch a wall or something. You know, these are the fantastic old classic tracks that bring out the best in the drivers, because even if you're not a, for the drivers who aren't necessarily F1 historians, they've all seen some of the great races around Monza or Spa. You know, Germany as well, I don't understand how they could not make that work. If you can't make it work with the German four-time world champion...
And you've got Mercedes winning Mercedes as well.
And you can sell out 12 times a weekend in DTM.
Yeah.
You know, that's and a
something doesn't
thing.
Make
that
sense
doesn't
here.
Doesn't make sense.
No. And Sebastian Vettel in a Ferrari, of all things.
I know. Absolutely.
I mean, maybe in a Red Bull there was a bit of cynicism about the marketing, but Vettel in a Ferrari...
Yeah.
Maybe you could ask Bernie these questions that we're putting to you in Barcelona.
Jordan did try. I think as well as in the past, maybe, and Eddie put it to him, and quite rightly so, things like happened in the past and Bernie might have rescued them, so why not now? But also Mercedes as an international global company, especially in Germany, the rules are so tight on, you know, Mercedes can't suddenly hand over £5 million to bail out the German Grand Prix. I mean, that's not within the good of the nation. So
Bernie could hand over £100 million to bail himself out.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
So why can't Mercedes do that?
Study on, Simon. Okay. Sorry, I lost my place temporarily there. Yeah, okay.
You were criticising Bernie Eccleston, I believe.
Yes. No, I wasn't. We've got quite a lot of questions from our listeners and our readers. I mean, you're a popular woman, you are. this one comes from Muddly Talker F1, and I'm wondering if this is Murray Walker.
On Twitter.
But he wouldn't call himself Muddly Talker, would he?
No.
No.
I'm not sure if Murray is acquainted with Twitter. I handed him an iPad once to do an interview with Lewis and Jensen, and it was utter chaos. It didn't work. It just didn't work.
Okay, well, Murray, if you do listen to
us. I'd love it if it was, but I'm not sure if I've ever heard simply 140 characters from Murray.
Murray, you've got Lee's number anyway. The question is, if you could be Bernie for the day, what three rule changes would you bring in to improve the show? This comes from, Muddly Talker.
Yeah. Rule changes, I'm not sure if it would be a rule change, but I do miss the noise of the cars. Yeah. When I was a little girl and starting to go motor racing, for some reason I was always taken to Manicure, because you couldn't get up to any mischief there, so basically my father could just leave me for like days on end. And I do remember when they were starting up the cars, this is mid-90s, you would feel it under your feet, your whole body, which it would be, and that's the thing that I remembered more than anything. It was that, am I 12 years old and having a heart attack? Oh no, they've just fired up a car. It was your whole body was shaking. And I don't think what we have is bad. I just think that when you go and do, if you're a Goodwood or if you're at an event and they've got a show car or a couple of years old car comes out, and then you hear what it used to be like, that's when you hear, because we don't hear the comparison now, we just accept what we have. So I would definitely make the cars noisier again.
They sound flat, don't they?
They sound flat.
You've got the GP2 cars coming up, they make a nice noise.
But do you know the worst thing about that is that the GP2 race starts on a Saturday when I'm interviewing the top three drivers at the pen. So there is the comparison, because you can't hear the damn people who you're trying to interview. And then you're sort of thinking, oh, it's quite nice, this quiet Formula One. I could actually have a conversation with people. And actually, one thing that Jensen did say after the first couple of races, he wasn't exhausted. When he got out of the car, he wasn't absolutely drained and exhausted. He didn't have a throbbing head. Yeah. He certainly felt quite good because, you know, that whole noise and everything wasn't reverberating through him. So that would be one. Two more, good God, what else could we have?
What about, what would you do anything about the tyre situation, in the sense that it's for some people, it's incredibly complex, and, you know, what tyre are they on, why are they on it?
Is it good to have drivers asking questions in a race about who they're racing and things? I always think that's slightly odd. Who am I racing? Well, you're in second, and there's one man in front of you and probably, you know, 17 behind you or something. I do think the tyres should be looked at, and I also think that, I mean, was refueling a good thing? I don't know, but I'm not quite sure about all this, you know, coast and... I don't get very excited when I see a fuel graphic coming up on camera, and because you're saying, oh my goodness, Lewis has used less fuel than Nico Rosberg. They're still going to get to the end. Yeah. You know, unless there's five or six safety cars, I think that's, you need to have more reasons to actually be racing and overtaking, and not DRS passes is another thing that sort of annoys me, because as soon as he's in the DRS zone, well, what happens in another 1 second time, someone else is going to be behind you again, so you get a bit of movement on track. But is it manufactured? Well,
yes
it is.
I think I'd bring back a tyre war.
Tyre war would be fantastic.
Yeah, just get rid of control tyres. It's a bit old school these days to do that. I don't know if it's possible.
But then I wonder, what did Pirelli get out of it, apart from occasionally a whole load of abuse from people like us? You know, you've got to be quite brave to be a tyre manufacturer in Formula One when you're the only tyre manufacturer in Formula One, because no one ever says, well done Pirelli, that was fabulous. They only say, well, that was rubbish.
Yeah, that's the only time the tyre companies get any PR apart from the tracks, is when something goes wrong.
It's when it goes wrong.
Well, Pirelli Silverstone a couple of years. It's the only time.
Okay. Matthew Pope has a question which refers to the news over the weekend that Piëch has been ousted in a boardroom coup. Surprising news, I thought, actually, by Mr. Winterkorn. Anyway, the point of the question that Matthew sends is, you know, do you think we'll see Audi come in now?
Well, there are a lot of rumours, mostly started by Eddie Jordan, I think, about this happening. If you speak to Alan McNish, there was just a great moment. I'm probably being very indiscreet, but we were watching Eddie interviewing Bernie, and Eddie and Alan are always arguing about whether Audi will come into Formula One. And Alan, being Mr. Audi, is like, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. And then when Eddie asked Bernie the question, and Bernie said, I'll be willing to step down if Audi would like to come in, Alan just picked up a pen and threw it across the room and sort of, ah, I know this isn't going to happen. So whether they do or not, I don't mind, but I just can't wait to see Alan McNish's reaction when they all turn up and he finds out he's the team principal or something because Eddie Jordan tells him it.
Or the ambassador.
You'd have to think that it is an option, and the group have got Stefano Domenicali, haven't they?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You would think with appointments like that and then... Cool, yeah, stepping down, I don't know.
They know a fair
but
bit
it would
about
be fantastic
hybrid
if,
power.
It'd be fantastic, I think, if they did, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
It would, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the thing about Formula One is it's aligned itself now with the automotive industry by taking this hybrid route and appealing to engine manufacturers and, you know, manufacturers to come back into the sport. That's why Honda are in there. And that's why VW are closer now than they've ever been to saying yes to it, because suddenly it's relevant to them. But what it's ended up with is a sport that with cars that make no noise. So if they want to go back towards a Formula One that doesn't really relate to anything but just exists in its own bubble, which is what it was always like, for, you know, since the beginning, it could go back down that route. And we'd end up with private teams with specialist engines built by racing companies, but you wouldn't have the money coming in from the car manufacturers.
Yeah.
Which way is better?
I think the latter has its attractions, actually.
It does have its attractions, but it's a completely different mindset, and the sport wouldn't be churning through the cash that it churns through now. And that's quite a hard habit to break.
Well, as you know, you're dispatching me to speak to Mr. Max Mosley this afternoon.
I am.
Gulp.
Yes.
So perhaps I'll ask him.
Well, he could refound March, couldn't he?
He could.
He could, yeah.
Why would he want to do that?
Well, for the new Formula One.
Oh, I see. Yes.
For the new Formula One that Damien's just suggested.
Excuse us.
The new old Formula One.
Okay, back to Lee McKenzie. Ivor Bourne wants to know, Lee, whether you think women have the right mindset to compete at the highest level in motorsport.
Well, you would have to say yes.
You
otherwise
would.
I'll become the most hated woman within women that there's ever been. But... I mean, why not? And
yeah,
Jensen always says, when someone's asked these questions, there's always people that get asked there, Jensen always says, this isn't physical anymore. So if they're good enough to get there, they can get there.
Hmm. He says it's not physical anymore.
He says it's not as fit. You know, a woman isn't going to be disadvantaged driving a Formula One car because...
There's no, with power steering and stuff,
a lot
of the physical effort
exactly.
That might... have separate, you know, been a differentiator in the past. It's not there.
Gone.
It is not there. Yeah.
So, you would have to say in that case, if there are actually no restrictions,
yeah.
then why not?
Yeah.
But I am a great believer in women should only. But it doesn't matter what. You know, I'm not a fan of what I always call the token bird situation. Whether it be drivers, whether it be journalists, whether it be people on camera, or in any walk of life, and the same obviously applies to men. But obviously, it's normally. Women that this happens to, people should be there on merit, otherwise you end up doing a huge disservice to the people who are trying.
Yeah. No, I agree completely. And I have to say, when Bernie suggested, flippantly or otherwise, a few weeks ago, about a woman's Formula One World Championship, one of the great things that should appeal, I think, in sport, about motor racing, as in equestrian events, is they're two of the few arenas where men and women can compete on an even footing.
Yeah.
I mean, you see plenty of it in horse racing, flat racing,
yeah.
Steeplechasing, three-day eventing, whatever.
Yeah.
We don't see as much of it as logically we perhaps should in motor racing.
Mm.
But, I mean, you look back to Michelle Mouton in the early 80s in the World Rally Championship. You know, there's nothing that stopped her winning World Championship Rally. She was great.
Divina Galitza, she was a hell of a skier and a hell of a driver.
Yeah.
She was good. I mean, Desiree Wilson was the one of that period who
yeah.
I think... I mean, she won World Championship sports car races. She won
yeah.
She was very, very good. I mean, but at the moment, the woman racer who is probably best equipped is Simona Di Silvestro,
yeah.
who's, running, well, she's not racing, she wasn't racing at the weekend, but earlier in the season, she had a fourth in the IndyCar
yeah.
series, and she's had podiums in the past.
Mm.
You know, she has got something about her, and I'd love to see her get a crack. I don't think the same about Carmen Yorda, who's three seasons
yes.
being 4 seconds off the pace in GP3 doesn't really merit.
And I feel I don't know, that's a difficult one, isn't it? Because she's obviously been offered that opportunity, and who in their right mind, male or female, would say no to that? but the level of abuse that she has received, because she was qualifying at the back of the grid in GP3.
For three seasons.
No, she then got out her car, and Dean Stoneman put the same car in pole position the very next week. So, you know, I don't think people are knocking her unjustly. I think there is a reason, and that would be male or female. She, you know, shouldn't be there, as it were. But you can't criticise her for taking an opportunity that Lotus have presented to her. And that's the difficult one. You know, why would Lotus offer that job?
Lotus deserve.
They are the ones that, in my eyes, deserve the abuse.
I agree completely. I agree. I'm just saying that, you know, she doesn't.
No, absolutely.
It's the same disservice you were talking about before.
Absolutely. No, I do get that.
And the fault is Lotus's, not Carmen Yorda's. But
it's a good point about Simona. But she drove the Sauber a couple of times last year, but nothing really ever came of that.
No,
but
well, then, it all fell apart.
But then they were a team with eight drivers. Well, why wouldn't it?
I think it was nine drivers in there. But anyway, yeah. But it's a shame. And there are one or two, Tatiana Calderon's doing European F3 and is sort of in the midfield. Yeah. Bite Skavisa, a young Dutch girl who was dropped from the Red Bull programme, but has been given a chance in Renault 3-5 this year. She went okay at the opening round in Aragon, sort of... was around top 10 qualifying times.
I had no idea you knew so many women, Simon.
I think it's racing drivers, irrespective of gender, whether they've got two heads, whatever. they're just racing drivers.
Okay. Actually, there's another woman question here. I don't really like these, actually. But anyway, this one comes from... Well, I just think it's all a bit, you know...
I agree with you, Rob. I know what you're saying.
Anyway, thanks for sending in your questions. Don't listen to Rob.
I mean, thank you, Ian Miles, for the question.
But Rob doesn't like it.
Just had a quick lesson.
But must try harder.
Quick lesson in manners from Lee McKenzie. I used to get them from your father as well, actually. He used to say to me, "You can't ask that." Watch me, Bob. Okay. Anyway, Ian Miles wants to know, how does Lee McKenzie find being one of the few women in the paddock? But aren't there lots of women in the paddock?
Yeah, there are actually quite a lot. And then I always say something along the lines of, well, I hope it doesn't really matter. I mean, some drivers, you know, respond better to sort of women than others. But I have been bothering these people since the days of, in some cases, F3000, certainly GP2. I've bothered some in A1GP, some in DTM. Yeah. So I actually think that they just think, oh God, is she still here with that bloody microphone? They don't even say, oh, there's Lee. Or, you know, they do notice it sometimes, that, you know, because I always shove on trainers. I'm always sprinting around. Jeans sometimes are pretty top. I don't, you know, wear dresses or anything in the pit lane. So when you do meet them out for dinner, like, oh, it's like, oh my, you're a girl. So which I should take as a compliment, but sometimes you just think, oh, for heaven's sake, you know.
It's like newscasters have legs.
Exactly. It's along those lines. But yeah, I have known them, most of them, since before Formula One, apart from these terrifying people that have been born in the 90s, like Max Verstappen and things. That can't be right, can it? You know, you couldn't have known these people before you started Formula One, because you would have been at their christening.
The most terrifying thing about Max is that his dad is 12 years younger than I am. And I just think, how is that possible?
Yeah, I have similar feelings.
Even more so, I'd have thought.
Yes, thank you very much. Let's come back to 2015 Grand Prix racing, and we've had the news that Williams has posted a loss. We hear of 34 odd million pounds. Does that surprise you, in the sense that, you know, if they can't make money, how on earth are the smaller teams supposed to survive?
Yeah, but they're a team who actually turned things around massively in the last few years, so I'm not quite sure how much they've had to put out to be able to bring back. Was that also including, was that Grand Prix, or was that including everything that they do? Because they've got so many other different things going on. I don't know.
Exactly.
But I don't think it's easy for any team in term, you know, to try and make money. Which teams in Formula One actually make money?
Well, of course, Williams, as you just inferred, has many, many companies under one roof.
I think they have Grand Prix Holdings, which is bits for Formula E and things for Jaguar and all sorts.
And the Advanced Engineering Company is very, very successful, isn't it? I mean, it's a brilliant new technology company. So I don't know the detail. I hope I'm not doing Williams.
But I wonder, you know, they have had to turn things around massively. They've brought a lot of new personnel in. Don't come cheap. So I wonder how much they put out to be able to get back. I'm not acquainted with these huge amounts of money, so for me it's all a bit, it's strange, isn't it? Money at that just level seems virtual.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'm upset if I lose £25, let alone, you know, £1 million.
So I've heard.
Yeah.
On the subject of Williams, just back to sort of performance, what's the what mood have you gauged at the team this year, given that last year they were so close to winning a race and this year, you know, they're taking a step back really?
And not just a race, the last race of last year, to have two drivers on a podium and then to turn up, and Australia was tough, not to have Valtteri racing, I think, was difficult. I think he's been performing really well since he's come back, but so is Massa. He seems to have stepped up again. But yeah, they're definitely frustrated. They need to be doing an awful lot of work as we sit here and chat to try and close that gap down to Ferrari, and they need to use these brakes. But you know, Ferrari will be doing exactly the same. I'm not quite sure where they've lost it in comparison to where Ferrari's gained it, but hopefully they'll be back at circuits like Barcelona, where they've gone well in the past. Austria, they go well. So
it's funny though that we're talking about Williams with a kind of a negative slant. I mean, you know, 2011 or something, if you'd seen that Williams was the third best team on the grid, everyone would have been going, wow!
Exactly.
But it's all just relative to the fantastic year they had last year, that's all.
2013, I think they had, what was it, their toughest year that they'd had before?
Yes, yeah.
You know, so the fact that they had that incredible turnaround, but people have short memories, don't they? Now they've tasted that champagne, they want it all the time, and I suppose we should be happy that they're able to mix it up and maybe get in the way of a Mercedes or two.
Yeah, I mean, even though they've gone a little bit back, things are a lot better,
yes,
generally,
absolutely,
than they have been for quite some time.
How far ahead do you think Mercedes actually are? I mean, are they cruising a bit? Or because if they're not, they haven't got, I mean, within a few races, hopefully, they're not running away with it, or are they, do you think?
Well, there were signs, you can't say glimmers of hope when two people have brake-by-wire problems in Bahrain, but you have to think of it like that. That, you know, the times where it didn't go overly well for Mercedes last year were either because their drivers were sort of getting in the way of each other, and it still worked out well for one of them normally, or they had a problem like in Canada that affected both cars at the same time.
Yeah.
And there was a little glimmer of that in Bahrain, wasn't there, that when all of a sudden that both cars got exactly the same problem at exactly the same time. So I don't know. I mean, even when they don't finish free practice one and two on a Friday because they're trying something different and they finish in 15th and 16th like they did in Bahrain, they still blast it. You know, Lewis is still getting the car and being 0.4 ahead of Sebastian on a Saturday afternoon. Yeah. I don't think they're in trouble.
I mean, there have been a couple of times in the races when Lewis has been tooling around at such and such a pace, and then just every so often if Nico gets called in first or whatever because to cover Sebastian, and then Lewis just puts his foot and suddenly there's another half second just materializes just
absolutely
like that.
That's why I was
wondering. So I mean I'm whether you could do a whole race at that kind of sustained pace, I don't know, but
running out of fuel.
Yeah, but I think they still have something in the tank, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think so. I think Lewis certainly does.
Yeah. Okay. Speaking as somebody who does not have a dish attached to the side of my house, I would like to know about Formula One on the BBC. How safe is Formula One on the BBC, do you think? Are we going to be able to go on watching it? And if not, what?
Well, that's a very optimistic question that I might know the answer, because I didn't know, and nobody did, that we'd lost the rights until we'd lost the rights to have every race live. So I remember coming down for breakfast in Hungary and whatever race, whatever year that was that 2011? I can't remember. Yeah. And seeing my boss sort of standing behind a yucca plant, and I thought, oh, he's not meant to be here. And that's when we were told. And then we just had to go into the track and get on with their work. So these things we tend to find out when everybody else finds out, or with half an hour's notice. I would absolutely hope that the BBC One say they're totally committed to Formula One. The viewing figures that they get, you know, can be 5 million for a highlights race in Bahrain or something like that, which is incredible. And Abu Dhabi, I think we had, was it 8.9 or 9.8 million people to watch Lewis Hamilton. You don't get programmes bringing in things like that anymore. It's not like when 12 million people used to watch Coronation Street or something. So you'd have to hope that if viewing figures do matter to the corporation, that they would stick with us, because week in, week out, week in. The fact they're showing, when we're live, I present Free Practice 1, 2 and 3 on BBC yeah, 2. Yeah. And we will get more for Free Practice 3 on a Saturday morning when we're live yeah. than Sky will get for their race coverage. Now, that's just, you know, that's nothing detrimental about Sky's coverage. No, that's sure. just what the BBC
yeah,
does.
Yeah, sure.
So, but the fact, and, I mean, some this might be some people that have forgotten to turn the television off after watching, you know, Escape to the Country for the 100th time or something.
I don't think so.
But people do watch us, and the fact that they're committed enough to put on Free Practice 1, 2 and 3, and now we've got a programme called, I think it's called Grand Prix Rewind.
It is
where Murray Walker looks back at different races with Susie Perry, and that's lovely. So they're actually putting more Grand Prix racing on terrestrial television, which is lovely. So you'd have to think that they are committed, you know, and personally I can only hope that they are.
And course to seven in the middle of the world news as well. I like it. It's all good.
Yeah, and Inside F1 is a programme I do every Friday and Saturday night from a racetrack, and that goes out on the BBC News Channel within their sports day, and you know football and everything maybe gets 5 minutes, and we get to do 10 minutes from a track with a Toto Wolff or a Nico Rosberg or you know a Max Verstappen or anyone who has the misfortune to walk past me when I'm on air. I'll grab, and it's and that's lovely, and because you see it from a different perspective.
It's good. It's good.
One of the interesting things about the BBC, a friend of mine who works there told me this, that even in this day and age where access to channels is so easy, if you haven't got Sky Dish, you've got free view boxes and what have you, the power of BBC One is still significant. You still get, for the same programme shown on BBC One or BBC Two, you always get a bigger viewership on
Absolutely.
On
one. I mean, I remember when the Great British Bake Off went from BBC Two to BBC One, that was seen as its crowning moment. BBC Two is a little bit edgy and cool. You sort of, you know, you're the sort of... not the most popular kid at school, but you know you're quite cool. You're sort of the indie person, whereas BBC One, you're out there for everyone, and it gets a huge inherited audience as well.
Amazing.
Which is, it is bizarre, isn't it?
Just one flick of a button.
It's bizarre, but I think that will become less important. People now watch online, and they stream things, and they've got apps on to be able to sort of enhance their overall viewing experience, which, you know... I don't know. I'm not really one of those people.
No, nor am I.
Well, most of us have still only got two eyes, so it's
I
do find it odd that people have, you know, got a stack of iPads and seem to be watching 15 different things at once.
Of course, we have a global audience for this show, for the Motorsport Magazine podcast. Many people from many different countries. So, if you're listening to this conversation about the BBC, I hope that some of you get the BBC coverage, and if you don't, I hope that you're getting your Formula One coverage without having to pay too much money for it.
And I will also say something as well. People seem to get very annoyed when people talk about, you know, we mentioned the Sebastian and Lewis feature, and then they go and watch it, or they try to watch it, and it comes up and says not available in your country. That is actually, because I get shouted at a lot by nameless individuals on social media, but that's not a BBC issue. That's a Formula One management geo-blocking issue. So anything which is filmed within the confines of a racetrack can only be showed in the country that has the rights. So we are the British rights holders. So people in Germany aren't meant to be able to watch that. They always have their ways, because RTL and Sky Deutschland are paying an awful lot of money to have Formula One, and that is the reasoning that that sometimes people abroad can't actually watch the BBC coverage.
Yeah.
And it is really frustrating, but that is the caveat. So sorry, world.
You must be able to see in your position how much potential there is to what you could do if there weren't all these stupid rules and regulations.
Absolutely. I mean, there's so many things that we just can't do.
Well, especially bearing in mind that if you love football like I do, wherever you are in the world, you can watch the football. It's one of the joys of when you get bored on holiday, there's always a football match. Anywhere, you know, I mean, it's fantastic. And why can't we have that? Actually, we don't want to go here, do we?
No, I don't.
Do we want to get into the complexities of the commercial rights and
it's a point. I mean, when I was covering all the Grand Prix, I mean, it was always quite nice on a race in Asia somewhere on a Saturday evening. You could just sit down with a glass of wine and watch Premiership football in Singapore or Malaysia without having to pay for it. Whereas back home, I would have to pay for it.
But the other thing, it's a funny one, because last year, I've never experienced this because I'm normally at the races and having a lovely time. But I missed Germany and Hungary last year for the Commonwealth Games, and we weren't live in Germany, and it was hard. I didn't have Sky because I was zooming around all the time. So I I watched RTL, yeah. And I was able to watch it, but I did have to sort of try and hack in and change VPNs and all other things, which I don't even know what they stand for. And it was, it's not easy. And I saw it for the first time from a different point of view, because I was in a hotel trying to prep, and I thought, well, I'll just stick the F1 on. Mm. I thought, how am I meant to watch it? I don't have Sky. No. BBC aren't live.
It's not easy.
So I do have sympathies for people.
I watched Jenson Button win the world championship on RTL in a hotel.
Did you?
With German commentary, obviously. Yeah. But I got the gist.
Yes. Yeah. He won. In case you didn't realise that translation, he actually won. It was
2009, wasn't
it?
Yeah, it was. Oh, yes. Okay. Let's finish on one final question. And it's completely inevitable, this question, but I think it'd be fun to hear your answer. And it comes from Colin Keenan. And he wants to know, Lee McKenzie, who, in your opinion, is the out-and-out fastest driver in Grand Prix racing, and who is your personal favourite?
You would have to say, at the moment, Lewis Hamilton is out-and-out fastest driver. Would Fernando Alonso be the out-and-out fastest driver if he was in that car? I don't know. I think he is an incredible talent, and it does frustrate me that we haven't been able to see him hopefully do what he was meant to do, but maybe, did he have a Ferrari?
We will.
But hopefully, we will. Favourites is always a difficult one, because I'm not really allowed favourites. I would have to say, Sebastian, Jensen. I mean, I have no problem at all with Lewis. I get on really well with Lewis, and we have some lovely interviews. But Lewis, quite rightly so, has to just protect himself from media intrusion, so he can be sometimes a little bit distant. But where Lewis is really strong is when he sits down with a Sebastian or a Stirling Moss, like we did last week. And then he's like, when he's with someone like Stirling, he's like a little boy again, So I think I'm lucky in that I have good relationships with all the drivers. Kimi is a difficult nut to crack, let's say. He's a difficult person to even get a mic to interview.
He's very talkative in the car, but he's...
Yeah, exactly. So we don't always get the opportunity to interview him, because he'll literally come in, do the finished journalists, and sprint out. So, but in terms of looking forward to listening to people, and the same with Fernando, actually. I like speaking to him, because he can say things that he's just definitely not meant to say.
Yeah.
You know, he loves nothing more than having that sort of twinkle in his eye and completely blowing whichever team he's driving for at the time out the water, and then just leaving the press officers flustered in the background to pick up the pieces. So, but maybe the people that I've mentioned come with experience. You know, they know how to play the game as much as anyone. So, but certainly, you know, Sebastian Jensen would probably be the two that I look forward to sitting down with.
We had a letter recently, which is, I think it was in one of the recent issues of the magazine, from someone saying that how can these guys be interesting people when all they've done, someone like Max Verstappen, all he's done, he's 17 years old, he's not lived, and all he's done is live racing. He hasn't got any sense of perspective. But I think it's a bit harsh on these guys. I think in a different era, they'd be just as interesting as the drivers in the past. It's more of the confining nature of the sport these days, isn't it, rather than the actual characters.
Yeah, I mean, that is an interesting point, though, because I do maybe think that that's how people saw Lewis and Max. They were sort of kind of hothoused to be Formula One drivers. And it's only recently, I think, that Lewis has been confident enough to show a little bit more of the person he is, and he's getting an awful lot more life experiences, so he doesn't shy away from the fact that he bought Prince's guitar for a ludicrous amount of money or something. You know, that's just who he is, and that's fine, and you either like it or you don't. And I really like that about Lewis at the moment. He's true to himself. He's so true to himself, more so than we've seen before. But that's where somebody like Mark Webber was fantastic, because he'd walk past me and be like, God, Scotland were utter rubbish in the rugby again, weren't they? Hi, morning, Mark. Thanks for that. But he actually had... There's not many drivers who have interests outside of Formula One. Mm. And they are the people that become much more rounded. I mean, there is more to life than just beeping in and beeping out of a paddock Thursday to Sunday. But I think the as I sort of said, by the drivers I named, you only get that maybe through age and a bit of experience.
I'm not so sure with Seb, though, because I remember I first interviewed him when he was... It was probably when he was a BMW reserve in 2007, wasn't it? And we arranged an interview with him, and because he was easy to get hold of. And we said, and within 10 minutes of meeting him, we were chatting about Beatles vinyl.
Yeah.
And stuff.
He's always been really good that
way. I just thought, what an interesting kid, because he'd got so many odd experiences, which are just, well, not odd, but I mean, odd for a young racing driver.
Yeah.
And he was just such a rounded, an interesting guy to talk to. I could have spent most of the day chatting. Well, I probably did, actually. And I remember wearing a Beatles T-shirt to a race not long afterwards, and he was sitting, it was in the Toro Rosso by then, and he was sitting in the car, and he saw me walk past with a Rubber Soul T-shirt on, and his thumb, you know, thumb comes up, and he spotted it and, you know, clocked it.
Beatles is always a nice way to get a good interview with them. He used to get very excited because he'd see my dad, and if I was talking to him, he'd be like, Father McKenzie, because that was always one of the lyrics. My dad was like, you know, I've been around for ages. I went to Ayrton Senna's funeral, and I've got some kid calling me Father McKenzie. Like, no wonder he retired. I think he did enough by that point.
That is brilliant. That is such a reassuring thing to hear about Sebastian Vettel. You know, I've always thought I'd like him. Fantastic. Thank you so much. Thank you, Lee McKenzie, for coming in today and your busy, busy schedule. And when can we see Moss and Hamilton at Monza then?
I'm not quite sure. We'll be talking about that. Maybe either Canada, or I would quite like to use it at the British Grand Prix, having two British such stars alongside each other. And it was lovely. And Sterling was fabulous. Yeah. And lots of use of the word crumpet and boy and other things that he was just, it's just Sterling through and through.
Yep. Good. We all look forward to that. And we look forward to your reports on the website too, of course.
Yeah,
absolutely. On
much.
The Mondays after the Grand Prix, when sometimes you're sitting in an airport feeling tired and other times you're up and everything's fine. Good. We like all that. Thank you very much to Ed Foster for putting our little podcast together today, as usual, and to our esteemed editor, Damien Smith, who is here with us, and to Simon Aaron, and of course to Alan Hyde, who makes sure it's all recorded and you can hear it. So we look forward to seeing you next time, and thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.